Yo, welcome to Beast Podcast. And if you don't know, Beast stands for bringing empowerment and skills together. And that's exactly what we strive to do on this show. We talk life skills, we talk financial literacy, we talk personal development. All these things are going to help you be a better you. So stay tuned and enjoy the show. Yo, yo, yiggity, yo. Welcome back to the Beast Podcast. It is your host, Deshaun Beasley. On today's show, we have a very special guest. We have Anthony Freeman. He's sharing with us his story on, man, like, his story is so inspiring, man. Like, you talk about life dealing you a bad hand and, you know, really feeling down in the dumps and that dark place, like, Anthony, you know, talks about his story and how he was able to, you know, come out of that dark place. And when I say dark place, I mean like dark, as in like death dark, as in like died and then came back to life dark. So we'll talk about that in this story. But very inspiring, man. Somebody who's actually got acquainted with through Colin Brown. He's been on the podcast, and Quavon Watts, who's also been on the podcast. We have a men's group that meets on Thursdays. From 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern time. And it's basically just a platform for us to learn and develop as men. So we go through different educational courses, learning how to be better men, learning how to lead, learning how to develop a vision. And I ask everybody in the group, you know, hey, I need y'all on a podcast, because it takes a very special individual to really invest the time into themselves, right, into community with other men. And I think that that's powerful. And his story itself is powerful. So hopefully y'all enjoy it just as much as I did. Let's get right into it.
Yo, yo, yo.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
We are live. Welcome to the Beast Podcast. Hey, but everybody who hops on the podcast, just start off by introducing yourself, where you're from. And then also, most importantly, three things that you're grateful for.
Let's see. So my name is Anthony Freeman. I'm from Gravel Ridge, Arkansas. Small little town. And three things that I'm extremely grateful for is my immediate family, first and foremost. My faith, my friends.
Amen. Amen. Sure. We going to... Like I said, hop right into it, man, because you have an interesting story that I was able to take a look at the videos you sent me. And man, I think you'll explain it a lot better than I have, you know, a lot better than I will. So I guess if you would like, I mean, you could start all the way at the beginning of, you know, growing up in Arkansas. And then once you realized the situation that you were kind of placed in and how you had to pretty much fight to survive, in a sense.
Oh, for sure.
Pray to survive.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, man. Like I said, I'm from Gravel Ridge, Arkansas, small little town in a small state, a small rural state at that. So you kind of don't have an idea that you're living in the middle of nowhere until you have an idea you're living in the middle of nowhere. But I'm one of four brothers. I'm actually the middle child. And single parent household, man, pretty rough upbringing. You know, my mom always consistently worked 3 to 5 jobs just for us to eat. And I wouldn't say she did it alone. You know, we had my grandmother and my uncles, but we consistently moved around the town. We consistently moved back and forth from a small town to Little Rock, which is the capital of Arkansas. And man, we were pretty much in some of the worst parts of Little Rock, always anywhere where Section 8 or housing was accepted. You know, that's where my mom would move to. And it just got to the point to where, you know, I mean, basically not even for 6 to 8 months, we wouldn't be in one place. You know, it was just constant moving this hood to that hood, to this hood, to back to grandma's house, to this hood, to that hood, to back to grandma's house. From this hood to that hood, and just so on. It's kind of like that for the first, I say, 8 to 11 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point to where we could make our own decisions pretty early on, and I decided to stay with my grandma in Gravel Ridge. And it turned out to be one of the best decisions I made because, you know, the exposure from being in the country, one of the only black families in the small town, and then being in the hood to, like, you know, you guys, like, you know, y'all whitewashed, you know, y'all ain't from around here, bro. What y'all doing around here? To going back to, like, the small white town to where it's like, oh, that's the black family. You know, it was like a struggle, a power struggle, I would say, internally, because it was just never like a sense of fitting in. I would go to the white school when I was living with my grandma. Then I go to the black school when I was living with my mom. And so it's just like a paradox, almost a mix of two different lives. So I had to grow into myself as I got older. And I've actually grown to appreciate it because it made me more diverse and less ignorant to ethnicity, if that makes sense.
I was gonna say definitely, because that's something, I mean, I'm sure, I don't say I'm sure, it's something that I've experienced just being in school settings where, okay, you for me, like, I played sports, so I'm with a bunch of black kids. And then I go to my honors classes, which are the higher academic classes. Right. I'm the only white kid. Mm-hmm. The only black kid. So it's like, you got to learn how to, I don't want to say it's hard to really find yourself, because are you trying to affirm yourself, or are you trying to seek validation from other people? Or, I mean, who are these? You got two separate groups. So do you got to live like two separate lives? It's a challenging time for a preteen or a teenager.
Oh yeah. It's actually pretty fragile too, because that's the time where you want to fit in. That's the time where you don't have an identity. Your identity is in your friends and the sports and the things that you do. So trying to find that group in that fragile time of wanting to be a part of something, it's pretty rough. It's really rough. And like you, man, that's where I found my relief, is sports. You know, sports and art has always been just the foundation for me since I was young. You know, I'll trace back to this story later on, but my uncle, he, you know, sadly passed away of scoliosis pretty recently, but he was the driving force behind sports and art for me. He literally littered my grandma's house with all of his paintings, drawings. I mean, throughout the hallways, throughout her room, his room. You know, he was kind of like the artistic creator rebel in the family. And he's the first one to live out of state. He was the first one to be exposed to multiple trades, like welding and things like that. He was like the first one to build his own car, which, I mean, I literally just built the car, you know, in his name, in his honor almost. But, man, I got a lot of my personality from my uncle. That's why I really love living with my grandma. But sports was the driving force behind finding that identity. And I was blessed. I was super blessed to be in the white neighborhood, so to speak, because one of the parents, you know, noticed that, you know, I was one of the good kids in the neighborhood as far as like sports and stuff goes. And if it wasn't for her, you know, she introduced me to organized sports when I was like in third or fourth grade. And it was my friend, you know, it was a white parent, crazy, crazy situation, but he was a mixed child and he didn't have any identification with being black or any knowledge of being mixed until we moved into that neighborhood.
Wow.
And the funniest thing is he used to knock on the door like, you know, my mama just hood as can be. He'd be like, can the black kids come out? She like, them motherfuckers got their name. You know, you better call them motherfuckers by their name. You know, excuse my French, but that's my mama, man. Like, it's so funny because, you know, Chris has grown into his identity too, but man, his mom exposed me to organized sports. And from that point on, I felt like I found my identity in sports, not people, not friends, but sports. Because, you know, you grow up in poverty and everything. You just want to escape, man. Sports, books, and arts. And that's as early as I can remember. It's just my uncle and my friend having that early influence on me.
Okay, so that's that brings us to what you said. You were about 10 or 11 staying with grandma.
Mm-hmm.
And you get introduced to organized sports. What was the sport that you gravitated towards?
Football, man. Football. I got to hit something. You know, it was a way for me to take out my anger. It was a way for me to to showcase whatever genetic ability God blessed me with. It was a way for me to, like, I don't know, almost mask who I was as a person. You know, that uniform is, it's not like basketball or track where you're fully exposed and you just have a jersey on. With football, you're like a knight almost. Like, you have armor, this shield, these helmets. Like, it covers, your identity is almost in that armor. So people see the poor kid who didn't eat for two nights. People don't see the kid who just got a whooping for stealing a kiwi out of the fridge or stealing a Hershey bar at the store. People don't see the kid who, played the imaginary game with his brothers of, we played this game called imaginary food, and we ask each other what we eating tonight. And, you know, I used to always say nachos, and my brother had burgers, and my other brother had spaghetti. And we didn't know that my mama was pulling overnight shifts just so we could eat the next day, you know? Just thought, like, man, why is she always gone? So that shield, that football armor, it literally hid the person that was struggling with life. It hid that kid away from the judgment of the public. So football was like the sport of choice for sure, man. I could lose myself on the field and just in my works of just, you know, athleticism, it was just insane how invigorating football was to me.
So I know you're known for being a track athlete. So when did that transition happen? Like, to go from football to track, to go from having your identity to being this noble knight that's just smacking the life out of people to somebody who just runs fast. Like, what was that transition?
Oh man, that's an interesting question, because at a certain point, I think early on in my football career, I was about 13. And I got to about 5'7", 290 pounds, man, at 13 years old. So needless to say, I was a lineman when I started out. And we used to have to do these drills. You know, our middle school was like down the street from my grandma's house. And it's in the middle of all of these hills. We call it the Four Hills. And they're like a couple miles in length, but height, it just keeps getting, you know, the incline just raises every single quarter mile, just about. And our coach used to make us run these hills, and the funniest thing is I used to always come in top five as a 290 pound line. and everybody used to be like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, how the fuck are you this, you know, fat? And excuse my French again, but this is coach verbatim, man. I never Coach Richardson, I mean, he was a redneck, I mean, exactly what you would see a Southern Baptist coach be if he's not at church. I promise you that. And he'd be like, how the F is your fat self so fat, but you keep coming in top five in these distance running? Have you ever thought about track? And I was like, man, what is that? And so he said, I tell you what, run track this spring, and if your fat self lose like 100 pounds, I'll make you starting running back your eighth grade year. And the funniest thing happened, man. Over that summer, I did distance, and I didn't quite enjoy it, but I would get lost into the world of running. You know, I could run out all of my emotions. I could run out all of the things that I battled as far as growing up, you know, fighting with my brothers, fighting people, fighting. And I could just get lost in running. And it was like another outlet besides football. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed, you know, just being able to just focus on nothing but my body in the moment. And next thing you know, it's like hours would pass by sometimes and I'm still running. And I realized I had a gift to run, you know. But it was like one of those things where, you know, seventh going to eighth grade, I ended up getting a bone infection from running so much.
Wow.
And man, God is my witness, I lost 110 pounds due to that bone infection. Insane. And guess what, man? I ended up being the starting running back my eighth grade year.
Whoa.
I mean, it's just insane just to think back to it. Like, I literally got a bone infection that would sideline me, and I lost 110 pounds, and I ended up being the starting running back and the team captain my eighth grade year.
Oh, wow. So like at that point in your life, you're you've kind of accepted this identity that I am an athlete. Athletics is what I do. Athletics is what I excel at.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about when was that paradigm that you had of yourself, when did that shift? Like, when did those life-altering events kind of happen? I mean, you're eighth grade going into high school. So talk mm-hmm. to me about that transition and what transpired next.
Got you. So believe it or not, you know, I identified as an artist before I identified as an athlete.
Really? And
yeah, I would, you know, draw Dragon Ball Z characters, anime. And I got to the point where I started like getting into realism and a lot of abstract drawing. I like the idea of being challenged both sides of my brain. And I was actually a smart kid, but I pretended to be dumb because I was trying to fit in and everything.
Right.
I felt embarrassed. I felt like, you know, I didn't want to be that black kid to where, you know, my black friends like, oh, dude, the nerd, oh, dude, the chump, you know. I didn't tell them that I won the Arkansas reading contest 3 years straight. I won 5 art competitions from 3rd grade all the way up to 8th grade. And I actually published my first book as a 3rd grader. And so I identify as an artist and sort of a poet before I was an athlete, which once 8th grade came, I completely said, I want to be a cool kid. I'm a team captain. Art is kind of for the gothic, nerdy type kids. So I kind of like lost myself in that sense of like being expansive, if that makes sense. Like I just wanted to be one dimensional, forget this whole nerdy type stuff. So yeah, I started getting really bad grades, but I would get passed just because I was a team captain, you know. Small town, I mean, it's exactly that, you know. You're a good football player, good basketball player, they're not worried about the grades, they're worried about you getting to the league and making that school look like, look what we produced, you know. So that transition that I started identifying as just an athlete was definitely 8th grade. And that was the year where the ego grew, everything grew. I didn't have to get bald haircuts anymore. So I decided, hey, I'm going to grow my hair out. You know, I'm going to be like Omarion. People don't even know Omarion was hot at the time, you know. And I was like, man, I'm going to get the braids, long hair, dark skin, dude. Oh, yeah, the girls going to love me, you know. And it just got to the point to where I thought I was invincible until the 2nd game of the season. We played Sylvan Hills High School, and I suffered an injury. I actually got hit very awkwardly. One was low, so it flipped me into the air, and one was out of the air into my rib cage.
Ooh.
And the craziest part is I thought I scored a touchdown, but I ended up passing out, and I woke up to snot all over my helmet. Couldn't breathe, didn't know where I was, how I got there, spitting up blood and everything. And you know, they scored off of that. It was 0-0 until the last, you know, minute of the game, and they scored off my fumble and my injury and won the game. And it felt like every breath I took, I was getting stabbed. Didn't know, man. I got rushed to the hospital and everything. And they're like, and you got broken ribs and your internal organs are bleeding.
Whoa.
Okay, cool. They taught us to be warriors, so another injury, another day. Okay. What does this mean? Well, they were like, well, at this point, you're going to have to take 3 years out and let your body heal. All right, wait, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th. I'll be a senior before I play again? Hell no. Hell no. Do you not know I got 4 brothers, a mama, a grandma, uncles, and we all come from poverty? I'm literally the only athlete in the family. I'm literally the only person that has this type of notoriety, this type of attention. Like, nobody in my family, even those who play sports, has ever came this far this young. There's no way in hell I'm sitting out for 3 years. To make matters even worse, they were like, well, you tore one of your kidneys and you bruised a spleen. And I'm like, man, what the hell does that mean? I don't even know what that means. Like, is it gonna heal? And they're like, this is real serious stuff. We're talking like stuff that could, you know, lead to death. So we need you to take 3 years off. Okay, cool. You know, get back to the season. They play like 5 or 6 more games. I'm on the sideline. every game crying. Mm-hmm. Don't understand why this is happening. Why me, God? Like, you know, this is like the opportunity. This is lifetime. And mind you, I'm only an eighth grade at the time, 14, 13. And I'm thinking about 24, 34. I'm thinking about the changes I can bring to the family. I'm thinking about income. I'm thinking about NFL. All these ideas of what I can be, me. And I'm not taking in the factor of this vessel that I have. I'm not taking in the factor of this health, this life. I'm not taking in the factor of my brothers, my uncles, my grandma. I'm not, it's all me at this point. And I'm cursing God like, why? This doesn't make sense. So at the end of the season, we had like two more games left. And I had a doctor's visit. You know, they asked me how I felt. Felt really good. I'm still working out and everything. And I was like, man, is there any possible way I can play? And the doctor looked at me. Then he looked at my mom and he was like, I'll be honest with you. You're healthy enough. You're young enough to recover. It's solely up to you and your parents to decide whether you play or not. Oh, I puppy dog my mama, man, gave her the puppy eyes, man. I'm like, you know it. And I can feel the tears right now because I knew she was going to say, yeah, I know she loved me playing sports. And I know she know what I feel. She know the whole struggle, and she knows this is one of the opportunities that we can take to get out of the hood, you know. And she let me play. You know, one of the best but worst decisions ever made in my lifetime. I played, finished the season out pretty strong. Only played three games that year and was like one of the top rushers in Arkansas as far as running. And so it was a lot of pressure going into that ninth grade season, which I didn't keep up with numbers at all. My friend Adolph Stevens, he was an amazing athlete. He had a lot of rushing yards. Vinny Osmond, amazing athlete, a lot of rushing yards. Like, these were like top tier guys, which those are still my good friends, and they grew to be collegiate athletes and everything as well. But, man, this is not taking away no shine from them. But I didn't know numbers. I didn't know anything. I just played, you know. So, statistically, going into our freshman year, we had a lot of expectations, and especially for me because of the injury and having that many yards in such few games. I ended up winning the starting position over those two. But it was interchangeable. Like, you know, I'll play like a couple quarters and then they'll finish out, or they'll start it out and then I'll finish out. Like, it was just, you know, small town kids, man. We played every single position. So if one of us was tired, one got in. So ninth grade came, and that's when I really like showed out, man. I was safety, kick return, punt return, and starting running back. Man, I raked up the yards. I raked up the tackles. Top defensive player in the state and a top offensive player in the state. And you talk about attention. Oh, man, like, I mean, it was just insane. You know, my mom was happy. My family was praising me at every family reunion. Man, we like, we going to do this. This is going to happen. The varsity coach came to me at the end of the season and was like, don't expect to be my starter next year. And I'm like, what the hell? What you mean, dude? Like, man, y'all see us, like, raking it up? The funny thing is, 8th and 9th grade, we went 0-10.
Oh, wow.
And I had a chance to transfer to a big-name school, a big-name high school to do sports, like Little Rock Christian or CAC, but we wasn't in jurisdiction, and we just didn't have the money to pay for those, like, private schools. So I stayed with the small school. And 10th grade is coming up now. I ran track ninth grade season. I raced against track athletes. And this one, I kind of transferred into a sprinter. And it's funny because I tried to do distance and I realized I get tired. It's just the funniest thing in the world. And I only did track that year just to get faster for football. It wasn't anything I was trying to do. Like, I wasn't trying to win. You know, yeah, we got some scores and everything, raked up the points, but I didn't place at all in ninth grade in track and field. It was just – so 10th grade comes, we had two-a-days and everything, and at this point, I'm squatting 500 at 5'9", 160. Oh, yeah. Had the squat record as a freshman. Upper body, we ain't going to talk about that, man. I couldn't bench for nothing. But lower body, man, I was deadlifting about 500. I was squatting about 500. You know, I was doing lunges with 100-pound dumbbells and stuff like.
Yeah, you got country legs. Yeah, you really got country legs. Some country natural,
man. And the funniest thing is my friends, they all start growing to like, you know, 6'1", 6 foot. And I'm stuck at like 5'9", man, but still just outdoing them. You know, I got faster and everything. And coach was like, hey, you know, the season coming up, the summer or spring season coming up, we've been training for about 2-3 weeks. All y'all need to go get physicals, including you, Mr. Superstar. And I'm like, oh, man, they ain't make me take a physical in ninth grade. Why I got to get a physical now? So I goes and get a physical, man. My blood pressure was like 180 over 100. And
For reference, what is that? Is that high or low?
That is extremely high, like heart attack high. Wow. For reference, I think regular blood pressure is about 120 over 80. Just elevated to, I think they did it 3 times and it got up to 200 over 110, which is literally stroke. And they were like, yeah, you need to be admitted immediately and tested. And I'm like, yo, I got practice tomorrow. Can this wait? I'm like, I'm a kid, man. You know, I'm about to be 15, man. I'm going to start the school. Like, you can't tell me nothing. They like, this is something that you need to look at immediately. So it goes into the hospital and everything. They run some tests and they're like, well, we got to keep you overnight to do a biopsy. And a biopsy is basically them going into your internals and getting a sample of like organ tissue inside of your internals so they can like determine whether or not you have an almost organ failure, so to speak. And lo and behold, man, they did a test, and I was in end-stage renal failure. And for people that don't know, that's a debilitating kidney stage to where, to the point to where there's no, as of now, there's no medical cure to sort of revive those kidney or that kidney. And, we didn't know what that was. We our family doesn't have a history of kidney failure or anything. So, you know, it's news to everybody. You know, the question is, what's that? What's next? Mm-hmm. So and it's another injury and like, we're just going to be able to, you know, go from there. And, you know, they started explaining to me exactly what the next step is. And the next step was dialysis. And never in my life heard of that. Ever. They showed me what dialysis was. I lost it. You know, it's a 15-year-old kid at the time, and you're telling me I'm going to have to be on a machine. Are you kidding me? Like, I have practice this week. I have a college to get to. I have the NFL to make, and you're telling me I'm going to be on a fucking machine. I'm 15. There's no way in hell I'm going to be on a machine. Mm. There's no way. And the doctor said the only other option is death. Man, I looked at my mama. I said, Mama, you got to let me die.
Mm.
You know, probably one of the most heartbreaking times of her life and mine. You know, man, it's making me tear up just thinking about it. You know, I begged her to let me die. And I can't imagine me having a son and him going through something, and he's sincere about me acknowledging that he wants to die, you know?
Mm.
And it just, you know, it breaks my heart to think back to 15-year-old me telling my mom that my life, this is my life, and now that I don't have it, I don't want it. You know, I put my identity in sports for us to make it, and I don't want it anymore. This is what old people go through. This is what people who are terminally ill go through. This is what, you know, this is my ignorant 15-year-old mind. This is what ugly people go through, or sick people, or, you know, 90-year-olds. I'm 15, man. 15. What does that mean? Like, you know, they showed me the type of dialysis and that there'll be a catheter coming out of my stomach. Dude, I cried. I was like, fuck no, man. No, no girls is gonna want me with a captain coming out of my abs. That's what I said, man. I'm an old man, like, dude, I'm 15, man. Ain't no a captain coming out of my abs, man. Ain't no hoes gonna want me. You know, that's exactly what I told my mama, man. Like, it's insane, dude. Like, I'm looking back at myself, like, oh, dude, oh, if I could go back in time. You ignorant young man.
I also just want to pause right there too, because while you were having these thoughts as a young man, think about how many adults have these thoughts now. Now, I'm not saying that their situation is as extreme as, you know, kidney failure and having to be on dialysis, but how many times do we encounter a situation and we just accept the fate of the situation, but we can't see ourselves on the other side? Like, We're wrapped up in an identity of ourselves. Once a situation happens and that identity gets stripped away from us, we're just like, okay, instead of recreating myself, we're just like, oh, well, whatever. It's over now. Like, how often do we do that? And I just think that it's just powerful that while identity is important and we need that as humans, like, we can't let our ego or our identity be the driving factor. Like, it should be... I guess a quote, our emotions, or I'll replace emotions with ego. Our ego should be a servant. It shouldn't be our master. Like, we shouldn't let our ego drive the things that we do and our reaction to things. We should use our ego to help us, support us in whatever it is we're trying to do or whatever challenge we're trying to overcome. But I just wanted to catch that gem and throw it at you, because, I mean, I can remember multiple situations in my life where I let my ego get in the way, and my ego was the one that was causing me all the harm, like, more so than the actual adversity I was going through.
Right.
But I just wanted to throw that out there, but you can continue with the story.
No, man, that's powerful, because most of my life, especially post renal failure, has been ego driven, anger, very emotional. And a lot of turmoil was caused by me. Mostly, I would say 97% of the turmoil was my fault. And the other 3% is just the environmental influence I let, you know, pretty much entice me. Like, I grew up like this, so I gotta be like that. You know, I'm a product of my environment. One for me, so that's how I am. God done to me. Like, it was all ego driven. It was all, like, emotionally anger expression. But it's a powerful gem, because, man, people don't realize that we wouldn't be in this form of evolution at this point in time, 2022, if humans were not adaptive. And we don't realize that, because we take this 60, 75, 90 year blip in terms of infinity as this is life forever. This is so temporary, and people are caught up in their own ego that they don't realize that. Like, man, this is a blip in the system. This is not even, like, infinity. People can't even put a terminology or thought process into forever. But they think that heartbreak is forever. This poverty is forever. This how God created us. White people racist. This. Man, this is like a small blip in the terms of infinity compared. And we put so much into this little blip that we don't even realize that we're not even preparing ourselves to what's really life. Forever, infinity, that's really life.
And it might feel like the end of infinity or the end of life in the moment, right? But we have to learn the skill set. And that's why I love, like, meditation and yoga practices, because it really helps you detach yourself away from yourself.
Right.
Powerful, man.
Just a food for thought, because, you know, I'm not the only one who didn't realize that. Like you said, as Afer mentioned, I'm not the only one who thinks like that 15-year-old kid, you know, this is the end of my life. This is it. Man, we're adaptive. That's not it. At 37, that's not it. At 48, that's not it. At 58, that's not it. At 72, that's not it. You can transform for as long as you have breath. But we don't realize that because we breathe and put so much energy into ego, and ego tells us, you're done. Oh, you got cancer, you're done. Mm. Your cousin just died, you're done. You know, it is painful in the moment. But if you really think about just the transformation of thousands of years of human adaptation, dude, we are powerful, man. Mm-hmm. The mind is so expansive, and people don't use imagination to the point to where they can recreate anything. Nobody realizes that until they realize it.
It's so funny. I was listening to an audio program yesterday morning. I recorded a podcast about it. So for all the listeners, you probably already heard this, but they said, Earl Nightingale, he said, the only difference between man and a horse or a pig is that man has the ability to use his mind and imagination. Mm. Everything else in a human, a pig has and a horse has.
Insane, man.
It's crazy to think about, right? Like, like we're literally just animals that can think freely and do as we wish freely. But we don't use that faculty. We really don't. The human person only used 10%. Think about Jeff Bezos. He's only using 10% of his brain power.
Maybe even 10.2.
Right. Maybe. Should we even round it up? Let's just go ahead and round it up and say 11%.
Right.
But that's what I'm saying. The potential that we have in our mind and what stops us from using it is that ego, is the self created perception that we have of ourselves due to, I want to say outside forces, but to be more specific, due to our surrounding environment.
Agree.
Yeah.
Man, that's in that, man, I'm telling you, I'm smiling ear to ear right now because it's powerful, man. Once you know as a person that you have control over your imagination and your mind, there is no such thing as limitations. Mm-hmm. And it sort of manifests as you realize it, but man, we'll get to that. That can be another podcast for another day.
Yo, thank you for listening to the Beast Podcast. We hope that you learned something and are empowered and inspired to be a better version of yourself. Please go ahead and subscribe, like, share it with a friend, a family member, or anybody who can get some value from it. Don't forget to rate and review the podcast. All right, y'all. Be great.